All right, hello, Brady Bunch. I will begin by going around and greeting people, starting with Alice and Mark, Jill, Ruth Ann, Bob K, Jeff, Jim, Tyler, Grant, Marv, John, Karen, Drew, Gaffel, Mac, Joan, Noah, Linda, Paul, and Sabrina. All right. Let's see. So, in terms of announcements, this Sunday we're gonna have a guest speaker, and his name is Gyogu, and he's a Chan teacher. I think he's based in Florida. And he's the author of a couple books, and he has a one that's out recently. So this is part of his book tour, which must be a lot easier to do these days via Zoom. So his book, so on the front page of the website, we have a little thing about this event, and then when you go to it, you'll see the book. And it's a book that he's written about Hungzhir's silent illumination, and Hungzhir is one of my absolute favorite Zen Chan ancestors. So it should be really interesting. So I think it's a great opportunity. Plus, since Shambhala is the publisher, and they're advertising this as well. So who knows how many people might show up and how international a group we might have on Sunday. I think that's all. Well, people may have seen that there was an email sent out, and it's also featured in our newsletter for that's coming out tomorrow. A local Cambodia. Hi. Hello, Grace, Clara, and Josie. So there's a Cambodian temple not far from where we are that asked for volunteers from the local community to come and be allies during their upcoming New Year's celebration because of some tensions and violence and stuff toward Asian people recently. And they got a wonderful turnout. Good to know that they're fully staffed. I'm going to be going on Friday, I believe. So that should be very interesting to and I believe the if you look this temple, it's an open to the public New Year's celebration too. So even if you aren't one of the volunteers, you might want to, assuming you're local, you might want to just go check it out. Because to form these kinds of connections with other Buddhist communities would be very sweet. And a lot of times there's language and cultural barriers and stuff that mean that we don't end up really interacting, but this could be cool. Any other either questions about what's coming up or something that I'm forgetting to mention? Right. Oh, next week our precept series begins. So starting next Tuesday evening, we will be studying the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, which I think it will go 11 or 12 weeks, and the classes will be led by senior students who have received the precepts in the past, and so there'll be a different leader each week. And should be fun and fascinating. And if you are thinking about if you have not already received the precepts and you're thinking about doing that and formally becoming a Buddhist at our ceremony in June, you should try to attend these classes between now and then. And there will be the first year, it'll be an opportunity to receive the precepts, to take Jukai, even if you are far away and unable to get here. So don't rule yourself out there. We did actually have two people attend our ceremony last June or July remotely because they didn't feel safe even coming to the park where we had it outdoors. So I guess it's not going to be that much of a change, except that I did deliver their wagesas, which is what you receive when you take the precepts in our lineage. I was able to go give them that, but we will have to send the wagesas to people, and then you will need to arrange for another human being to be part of your ceremony to put the wagesa over your head. I guess that's it. So tonight is the last in our series of foundational teachings classes, which of course could have gone on for many more classes. I think we had eight classes in which to cover the basic Buddhist teachings. And this class is on absolute and relative. And the podcast, I saw on the list, on the syllabus, I had a podcast recommendation of, I think, like the second Genjo Koan podcast I did. But when I went to go prepare the class today, I'm like, oh, I should have done the podcast episodes on the Sandokai, but the harmony of difference and sameness. But this lesson, this teaching appears in many, many different places. So, all right. So let's dive in. So this teaching arose in China, and I'm not an expert on the history, but it makes sense that it arose in China, given the Chinese culture and other religious traditions and stuff, that, you know, Taoism, the way some things being beyond expression. So they had a much more non-dualistic approach to spirituality. So it developed that the Chan school, which is in Japan, it's Zen, and the West it's Zen. The Chan school began to emphasize how their reality has two aspects. And the terminology that we use the most often is absolute and relative, although there are many different pairs of terms that we can use, and I'm going to be introducing you to some of those. One of my favorite alternative pairs of terms is the one used by Ross Bolliter in the Dongshan's five ranks, which I'm going to be talking about a little bit tonight. And he calls it the contingent and the essential. So the relative is the contingent and the absolute is the essential. So just before we explore all the ways that these two aspects can be expressed, I want to say a little something about why. Why does this matter? Because these teachings can end up sounding a little philosophical, a little speculative, or something like, okay, well, you know, so Buddhism claims to know how reality is structured. I mean, who cares? You know, essentially, what does it matter? And essentially, it's because as long as our experience is limited to the relative or the contingent, which I'll be getting into that description, our lives are constrained and much more subject to stress and suffering. So last week we were talking about emptiness, which is essentially one of the terms that you might use for the absolute aspect of reality is things are empty, empty of inherent enduring self-essence. So in the Heart Sutra is Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. Prajna is wisdom and paramita is perfection. So the Heart Sutra says, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on Prajnaparamita, relies on this perfection of wisdom that all things are empty of inherent self-nature. And thus, the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So you realize complete peace, ease, freedom, liberation. So there's something here, right? We awakening to the empty nature of all things, being able to perceive the absolute aspect of reality, there's something liberative about it. There's something important about it. But, so we talked a little bit about that last week, and we'll have to touch on it again, of course, because that's part of this week's topic. But we're encouraged not just to wake up to the absolute dimension of reality, like see how everything is empty, but then to embrace what my teacher Kyogen called radical non-duality. So we try then not to even divide things into absolute and relative, but see that they're actually two sides of the same coin. So this can be kind of overwhelming, heady stuff. So kind of like, you know, let it go in one ear and out the other, and something may lodge itself in there, or something may inspire. So I want to share my screen, and this is my handy dandy chart of absolute and relative, and I'm going to read it too for anybody who can't actually see it. So there's two columns here, so I'm not going to be pronouncing these right. Sure is in the left column, it's the relative. And Li in the right column is the absolute. So language is, this is something that the Chinese really was part of their culture, in which they really, once Buddhism reached China, they really instilled into Buddhism as well. This appreciation that language can never express reality fully or directly. And therefore, these are different attempts. I think of these sometimes as like they're different artistic expressions. If you were to paint a sunset, you know, you'd capture something about the sunset, but you can't capture the sunset itself. So all of these pairs of terms and these descriptions are just, they're just, you know, human beings trying to put words to an experience. So going down the list, then there is the I'm just gonna make my thing a little bigger so I can see more of you. So the relative is the dimension of reality in which each and everything is defined by relative positions and qualities. Right? So I'm short, but I'm only short relative to most people. Small, tall, smart, stupid, almost every dimension along which we define ourselves or make sense of the world are relative terms. They involve measurement or comparison of some kind, and or, you know, who we are is relative to other people, relative to our culture, relative to the people, you know, when we go to work, relative to our coworkers and our clients. So this is the most obvious aspect of reality. But we also say, in the sense that we're pointing toward an absolute aspect of reality in which each and everything is part of a seamless whole. And this is like, okay, it can seem kind of maybe far out or supposedly transcendent or something like that, but it really, it points to an experience which all of us in some sense have intuited or tasted at certain moments, where everything just seems complete. For me, I find a metaphor that kind of works for this is to, it's like, I've said this before, like if you were a character in a movie and you were really absorbed in the drama and kind of really imagined yourself to be this character, you'd be, you know, caught up in your own role and story and experience and well-being. But then if you were able to step back and see, oh, this is part of a larger story. The reason that I, you know, had this hardship is because I was supposed to grow into this kind of person. Or, you know, if you were able to like view this, the whole plot from a larger perspective, it'll just be part of the plot. So there's sometimes when we can really perceive things like this, that it's, everything is just part of reality itself. Another pair is phenomena. So everything that manifests and happens. And then principle, the truth or reality underlying each phenomena. There's form and emptiness. So form, when we talk about form, that's one of the five skandhas, which is basically physical form. But that's just shorthand for all five skandhas, which is sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And that is meant to be an exhaustive list of everything that makes up a human being. So you may think like, well, how about this? Well, I mean, it's meant to be an exhaustive list. So everything that you think you are or can experience is included in this category. And then there's empty. All things are empty of inherent, independent, enduring self-essence. And emptiness, as the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Emptiness is a quality of form and phenomena, right? It's not a thing. It's not a thing unto itself. Emptiness makes no sense whatsoever unless there's something which is empty of enduring self-nature. There is individuality and uniqueness. I mean, no individual or moment or rock or particle of dust is the same. And yet there we all share this empty nature and are part of this seamless whole. So there's a sameness to all things as well. Again, myriad, separateness, one, a unity, difference and equality. So there are, you know, in the everyday world, there's helpful versus harmful. There's deluded versus wise. These, there are real differences, right? They have an impact. They matter. But then at the same time, everything is marked by emptiness and sameness and unity. Let's see. Other important aspects. I don't need to go too much more into this, I guess. I will actually, I'm going to paste the link to this PDF in the chat. So that if you want to pull it up and have it in addition to your Zoom, you can. So I will, there's obviously more to go into there, but I don't want to get too wrapped up in it. Before I go on, any questions? It's a kind of befuddling. All right. Feel free to just, you know, raise your electronic hand at any point. So waking up to the emptiness part, the absolute aspect of reality is not a binary thing. It's not a, you know, have you awakened emptiness or not? Yes, I've awakened emptiness. I awakened on October 15th, you know, 1995. I think of it as something that we become more familiar with, that we end up having intuitions of, than we have glimpses of, and we become more and more familiar with it over time. And then I strongly believe that every person at some moment has had some kind of intuition of this, you know, standing in nature, or I don't know, holding your first child or something, this experience that there's another way to view reality, another way to relate to it. Now, the result of awakening to emptiness is positive, kind of by definition. So if you think you understand emptiness and it sounds really nihilistic, or if you have some kind of meditative experience or something which seems kind of scary, or like you're going to dissolve or something like that, that is not, kind of by definition, that's not emptiness. And maybe kind of a partial, intuition, like, you know, you're like, you glimpse through the door, but then you were like, oh no, and you're not fully familiar with it yet, because it's not a nihilistic void. everything is empty, but everything's still here, and it doesn't need to have that enduring self nature that we imagine that it has. So that's why I like actually the Chan Master Hongzhi, which Gyogu will talk about this Sunday. He says, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Accordingly, we are told to realize that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. So the absolute aspect of reality is a place of, well, it's not a place. it evokes wonder. But the realization, like I said, of emptiness itself, emptiness and the absolute, are not the goal. Instead, it's integration, or truly understanding how absolute and relative are inseparable. So language ends up encouraging us to create dualisms. So a very typical way of Zen folk talking about absolute and relative is to say, in the absolute, there are no distinctions. In the absolute, good and bad don't matter. In the absolute, blah, blah, blah. In the relative, blah, blah, blah. There's no in the absolute, and there's no in the relative. There's just reality that has two aspects. Our minds want to divide it up, right? Like, for this moment, we saw how all distinctions are created by our own minds, and essentially we're boundless, right? And that seems to be a different reality than, okay, and then I had to stop meditating and now I have to take out the trash. It feels different, and it feels different at first. And this is why one of the coolest, I think, Zen teachings is Dongshan's, it's five ranks is what it's often known as, but Bolliter, the author, actually suggests it should be five Dharma positions, because rank sounds kind of, you know, good and better and whatever. And this teaching, just like teachings of emptiness and absolute and relative and stuff like that can be a little like, it seems unnecessarily philosophical perhaps, but the essence of it is this. The essence of it is that in the first Dharma position, you can think of it as we have no clue. We don't know anything about spirituality, emptiness, whatever. We're just, you know, we're caught up in the relative and doing our business, happy, suffering, this and that. Then in the second Dharma position, we get an intuition that there's another way of going about things. There's something more, if you will. We get an intuition of emptiness or Buddha nature or something. And there's something calling to us, something. So life starts to feel kind of incomplete, interestingly, and we're looking for something deeper. So that's that second Dharma position, which can be kind of uncomfortable. Then in the third, we kind of get it. We personally have enough of an experience of the essential of emptiness that, oh, we're like, oh wow. And then it's kind of it can be very special. It could be very like, that seems more real than the relative. Because it can be a little disorienting. I mean, sometimes this happens more dramatically, and you know, for people like me, it's just a very gradual thing, which is kind of merciful in a way. But basically, and maybe sometimes it's just in the middle of a retreat or after a deep meditation session, we just have a sense that that kind of spiritual realm is more real, and it's kind of out of reach. It's often out of reach. So at that point, there's a real sense of dualism between, you know, this kind of realm of unity and non-difference and no fear and all of that and our everyday lives. So the fourth Dharma position is when, okay, we gotta go on, right? So we get unstuck from this kind of attachment to or absorption in the absolute. But on the other hand, we can't forget it. We can't ignore it. So now what do we do? How do you bring this kind of stuff into your everyday life? How do you, you know, this transcendent moment you may have had while hiking where you realized everything was perfect just as it is, how do you bring that into your daily relationships? And this is like a fourth Dharma position practice where we're like, it's a struggle. It's just a lifelong process of trying to learn how these things relate in our flesh and blood and bones. And then, but also with a determination that the absolute needs to inform the relative, right? That kind of liberation and beauty and ease needs to be able to manifest. And then the fifth, I don't know if I've ever met anybody who's in the fifth Dharma position, is like complete integration, right? You get it. You see how absolute and relative are two sides of the same coin. You know, now you're just going to go about your life. You're going to, you know, deliver groceries or be a teacher or whatever. You don't have to like, oh, you know what? I realized the absolute. And then I realized that it was, you know, I integrated it with the relative. And, you know, you move beyond. You've integrated practice to the point where you don't have to talk about it anymore. So, I wanted to share another thing, which I don't know if you'll get anything out of it or not. But there are, like, in this book by Bolitar, Dongchan wrote a poem, actually wrote a couple poems, with five verses, with the verses, the paragraph, whatever, that correspond to the five Dharma positions. But they're kind of, you know, they have very ancient metaphors. They're a little, they would take some study before you really understood what they were getting at. So I decided to write one. So here's my five Dharma positions poem. So the names of it, I mean, they're named different things, but the contingent, so remember, the contingent is the relative, essential is the absolute. So this is the contingent within the essential. The contingent, like, relative is the, you know, the absolute is still true whether you are oblivious to it or not. So I say, humans bustle about their business, mighty and terrible, meek and compassionate. Who can say whether it all sums up to something good? And yet, in those rare moments, the perfection shines through. And then the essential within the contingent is the second Dharma position. Having lived mostly obliviously, suddenly something awakens that sets you on a search. True intimacy eludes, but beckons. You become determined to reach your home, although you have not yet been there. And then arriving within it, within the essential. Released from the prison of your own mind, stories and assumptions shed like a snake's loose skin. The mundane world is revealed as a radiant palace. You must now learn to walk and talk all over again. And approaching from the contingent. So the fourth Dharma position. The essential solves no worldly problems. And now you love the world and its beings even more deeply. With fierce determination, you strive to manifest emptiness in the midst of form for the benefit of all. And arriving at concurrence, the fifth Dharma position. The separation has been recognized as a fever dream. Now there is only the business of the universe unfolding through your eating and sleeping and farting. The sutras are no different than your cup of coffee. So, I wanted to put us into breakouts and ask each group to come up with one statement and one question. So one statement about emptiness or absolute and relative, or something that you pretty much, you feel like you can say is true. And one question about it that then you can bring back and share. So, yeah, I guess I'll just go ahead and do that. I will recreate and invite you. All right. I hope that was fun. So I'm hoping somebody from each group will share if you have a statement and a question. And I do have a little document that is going to write them in. And then we can talk about questions. So do we have someone willing to, I should have told you to pick a secretary. Someone willing to share a statement that, I don't know if this worked or not, but any statements that arose, something you felt you could say about absolute and relative? Alice.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Emptiness exists without form or senses. And one, when one senses emptiness, they also realize everything that binds us together.
Cool. Was there a question in your group too, as long as you
Yeah, I was gonna take the question.
Okay.
But one thing that's bothered me is for a long time, and I guess I remembered it today, was that, you know, we use words to try to approximate this, but words are really, at least to me, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, are completely in the realm of the relative. So communication like this is in the realm of the relative. So I don't even see how we can use these tools. It reminds me of a mathematical problem where you can't describe certain things within the system, right? Like we're trying to describe something outside the system that is not describable using the tools of the current system. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know. I didn't say it that way in our group, but I don't understand how words can be used to approximate the, maybe it's just an approximation, but how we can describe or even talk about the absolute.
Well, in the group, you're talking about how can we define something in the absolute with terms from the relative.
Right. Yeah. Let's put it in another way. Yeah. Probably a better way.
Cool. Another statement or question? Mark.
Statement was, life and I are what we have made of each other. I don't know that I have a great succinct way to put the question. And whether we should go with Linda's or mine. The relative is sort of the realm of ordinary beings. So, you know, if we aspire to Buddhahood, then is the relative less than the absolute? Is the relative something to be relinquished? None of the teachings treat it that way, but there is still that aspiration.
Good question. So there were four groups, two more statements. I don't know.
Well, our group came up with a question. This wasn't my question, but it's life seems really real, but is it?
Can I just ask, was that from Drew? That sounds like a Drew statement.
No, we'll have to let the person reveal themselves.
Wait, what? What did I say? Allegedly?
She was just wondering whether you were behind the question. Life seems really real, but is it? It was just a wild guess.
That one I would love to take credit for, but that one was not me.
We only have 10 minutes and we have 3 good questions, so if we could just jump into that. Woo! Well, there is a lot of, as I'm sure you are well aware, Mark, there's a lot of Zen koans that have to do exactly with this issue about communicating about that which is impossible to communicate. And yet, like, what if I just stop teaching? What if I just stop and everybody stop teaching and stop writing? Would you get it? Would you then just awaken to this on your own? Probably not. Are the words like crude tools? Yes, but somehow, you know, I guess I think about it in terms of it's like poetry, where really, really effective poetry is not communicating something to you. It is evoking something, right? We have a shared language. We have a shared experience. So hopefully, like, so if you didn't have an intuition, if you didn't have the capacity to experience the absolute aspect of reality, then there wouldn't be any point in communicating about it, right? But because you do, and it's like the words are coaxing it out or pointing you toward something in your own experience. So ultimately they should just kind of like, we call it the finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon itself. And yet if the point is to get you to look at the moon, then at least the finger does something. any additional thoughts or questions about that? Tyler.
It reminded me a bit of like, the question of like, can the master's tools, take apart its house or something like that? So like in a lot of activism work, or when I was in anti-poverty activism, I was getting tired of not getting anything done. So I was like, I'm going to go work for the welfare office. And I'm just going to like work within the system and try to like help as many people as possible. And I did that for a couple of years and found out that like, once you were in that system, I wasn't able to make the change that I wanted to make from within. It just wasn't happening because there were too many rules, too many things. But I liked what you said about poetry, because poetry that really like sparked something that it's using the words, but like it repurposes it as almost an entirely different tool.
Yeah.
So maybe you can, right? Because it's saying like, here's all the things, here's the language you know, but now I'm just going to take it and totally mess with its meaning. And so maybe that allows you to. I think that's really, and maybe that's why Zen, I don't know about other versions, but Zen seems to really like poetry and these sorts of things. Because yeah, you can use those, the tools we have, which are these words, but allow you to use your imagination and your, and yeah, I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it is really tricky. And it's like, yeah, so there's the koan of the, there's, you can't remember, it's like, so there's a teacher, God knows how he got in this place, I don't think it's meant to be real, but let's say, you know, so he's up a tree, he's holding on to the branch with his teeth, that's the only thing that's keeping him from falling and to his death, and somebody comes up and asks him for a word of Dharma. What does he do? And, you know, it's like kind of, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, like in our precepts, it says to say not one word is to keep the precept of not speaking dishonestly. The moment that we put it into words, it's not quite it. But how else are we going to share and guide each other. Is the relative less than the absolute? Yeah, definitely not. And that is what the, you know, that's kind of what that whole fourth Dharma position practice is about. And so I think it's good, whatever Dharma position you feel like you're in, to keep that in mind, right? So we're supposed to accept things provisionally, right? You're not just supposed to go, oh, okay, you know, absolute and relative are two sides of the same coin. That's what I learned in Buddhist Sunday school. But you just like, okay, that's what the teachings say. And then you're meant to explore those, but it might take many, many, many years of exploration before you have a sense of it personally. But, you know, just keep in mind that we're saying, no, the relative is not, but it can seem that way at first, right? Ooh, the absolute. You have to like meditate for a while or have a lot of spiritual insight in order to see this and let go of your mental map of reality. And then you see how that there is no boundary between things and all that. So it sounds really transcendent, but it is like, it's actually very mundane, right? It's, if you see a glimpse like this, it's not a far out like acid trip kind of thing. It's like the world that's why I said in my poem, like the mundane world is transformed into a radiant palace. Like you've been walking around just like, oh, I gotta go to a grocery store. And, you know, suddenly you look and like, wow, look at this. Look at this life. Look at this. Look at reality. So the relative, it can definitely, in parts of our practice, can end up seeming, you know, it's the realm of good and bad and struggle and suffering and all that kind of stuff. But we have to remember, it's, again, it's not a realm, you know, it's a way that we're relating to reality. And this other truth is always present. And the absolute or emptiness or all of those things are only characteristics of this crazy world, this crazy life that we're already very familiar with. So it's like seeing the true nature of this mundane existence is what this is all about. And life seems really real, but is it? Life ends up being, I mean, it is real, but what I want to say, our thoughts about it are not, or they are real thoughts, but they're not, they don't have the reality that we usually give them, right? Our decisions, our sense of ourselves, our sense of our lives, our sense of right and wrong, all of this is like, that's the stuff that's ephemeral and not, and is illusory in a sense. I mean, if you have a feeling, you have a feeling. So in a sense, it's a real feeling, but it may just be, you know, like passing weather. It's not really that significant. Doesn't have the significance that we usually put on it. So life just, yeah, that's that aspect where like the Buddha never even said the self doesn't exist. He just said that it doesn't exist in the way that we think it does. And I remember, this may sound ridiculous, but I remember sitting and, you know, in a meditation retreat or two where I'm, you know, if it takes me a long time, but I actually got kind of concentrated and settled and, you know, felt like I could start letting go of my sense of self and a lot of the mental frameworks that I spend so much energy keeping up. And then I would feel like, uh-oh, like, if I do go too far along that path. Like, it felt like I would just disappear. I would just blink out. I would just, God knows. It just, that'd be the end of everything. Which is like, that's of course what our mind is going to tell us, right? It's like, oh no, you don't do without me. You need me to hold this all together. But then, you know, when that drops away, that's the only thing that drops away. The only thing that drops away is our own mental shit. Everything's going on just fine. Your body's still working. You're still sitting there. The sun's still shining. The birds are still singing. we're holding it all together with our minds. And we're not. So I guess it's some brief answers to a few questions. And that brings us to after 9. So I'm sure all of you are leaving tonight with a full understanding of absolute and relative. But I hope that that's a nice little overview there. Looks like I saw somebody. All right, I will close with the verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Konbawa.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Ruth Ann, it was nice to see your face. That was my first time to see you.
Hi. Good night.
Good night.